Representative Slaway, please.
Yes, Representative Slaway, House File 1887. We're not quite at quorum yet, I don't believe, so we're not going to make any motions, but hopefully the next few minutes we'll do that. But why don't you get us going with House File 1887?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll wait to move the bill.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill you could do quickly, efficiently. It doesn't require a lot of money, and it does a lot of good. So with that being said, we hope we can make this happen. House File 1887 will coordinate services for children that are newly identified with hearing loss. Early childhood identification intervention is essential for their success. We need a coordinated education system that supports families and children with hearing loss, and providers and parents say the system is fragmented. So by providing a coordinator is very important. And this bill will help to ensure that deaf and hard of hearing babies will get the specialized educational intervention they need. So I have two testifiers. I have Dr. Peggy Nelson, who is going to go next, and then Rhonda Sabaraya, who is a parent, and then she will go after that.
Representative Slavik, I've been told that enough of our members have checked in officially, and so we will entertain your motion on House File 1887.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1887. I'm not sure
where
you want to refer.
We want to have it recommended to pass and refer to finance, and then this will also be referred to K-12 finance division. So that's your motion.
Yes.
So the motion is before us, members. Representative Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just told the committee about the bill. This concerns young babies and hearing loss, providing a coordinator for them, and why this is so very important. So I'm going to have my testifier go ahead with that. This is Dr. Peggy Nelson.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Dr. Nelson.
Thank
Please
you.
State your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Peggy Nelson. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota. I'm grateful to be here, Representative and Mr. Chair. I hope to convince you about this legislation.
Well, let's see, Dr. Nelson.
All right, let's go. I brought a little bit of information just about hearing loss because I think some of your members were not able to hear some of the previous testimony about the effects of hearing loss on people. Helen Keller is well known to have stated that her hearing loss cut her off from people more than did her blindness. And to tell you a little bit about families and what they go through.
And when we adopted her, we were so thrilled to bring her home. And we noticed when she was just an infant that she didn't turn and look at us sometimes when we talked to her. But we really couldn't tell what was wrong. By the time she was a year old, we took her in for her well-child checkup and asked our pediatrician. But he couldn't really tell. He didn't have any answers for us. I cried right away. I was just in shock. And I didn't know what to do. I've never met a deaf person, and I didn't even know what to expect. We called back the next day and said, well, does that mean she won't talk? What does that really mean? And we wanted to communicate. We were heartbroken, not that she was deaf, so much as that we didn't know how to communicate with her.
And that's what families tell us. They would like to do something, but they just don't know what to do, and they don't know where to turn. And so the purpose of this is to coordinate services for the families like this one. Some facts about hearing loss that you have in your handout is the most frequently identified disability among newborns in the United States, and almost all of the newborns with hearing loss have persons with parents who have normal hearing. And of course it's invisible and it has great educational costs because typically children with hearing loss have not learned at a typical level, and so their reading levels have not been good. I've been in this field a long time, and when I first started, this is what happened in schools. That's what she's saying. And a lot of the reason that was happening was because we didn't have access early. And this is one of our recent children.
She had one. The room went after the farmer's wife to cut off the tails with a carving knife. The dealer, she checked the thing in the right.
I threw
them.
She's about as cute as she can be. They had about the same amount of hearing loss, those two little girls, one from about 1975 and one from now. And the big difference, and there are other children here, but you probably don't have time to hear all those cute children. So how did we get to to hear from where we were. And the same is true for families who choose sign language or kids speech too. We've come a very long way since I was initially in this field. And the answers are that we have earlier identification of hearing loss, we have a better availability of better devices for the children, and we have high quality early intervention programs. And they focus on teaching language, whatever system the families choose. And we have advocacy and public policy initiatives that help us along the way. So we have early hearing detection and intervention systems in Minnesota, and we have some of the pieces. We have the screening. It's voluntary right now, and you'll be seeing more about that. We have audiologists who can diagnose the systems, and we have intervention people who can jump in before the age of 6 months, and then that can ensure that these children learn language typically like they should. We have good medical facilities for our children, and what we need to improve on is our data management and tracking and our program evaluation and quality assurance so that we get the whole support for the family. And this coordinator then is going to be a really key element to this coordination of services so that the pieces work together rather than working independently. States have identified, it's been a long ways, and they have identified a lot of children with hearing loss very early. If you look at the bottom of this list for Minnesota, we're not doing so well. We have a similar sample size to Massachusetts, but we're only identifying about 1% of our children as having hearing loss, whereas it should be, we know that it is more like 2 or 3%. So we're missing these. We're in fact in the bottom 5 of states. So what we're asking is that we invest in early hearing detection intervention coordinator to help us meet our obligation and coordinate the system, reallocate the resources that are available through IDEA and other places. We have a coordinator for K-12 education that we don't for the early. We spend money on early hearing detection and intervention teams statewide, and we have coordinators for the screening services. But at the bottom there, the families report that the system is difficult to navigate, it's variable between regions, and it lacks certain expertise and intervention for their children. So we're hoping to improve the system by reallocating existing resources, investing a minimal amount annually to leverage those resources and provide more uniform system delivery, add a coordinator and potential gain for by saving on educational systems. So we're one of the 5 states rated by the Centers for Disease Control with unsatisfactory performance. We want to change that. We want all hospitals to screen and improve the identification of infants up to the numbers that we know must be there, and then have an integrated system providing these measurable intervention goals for the families and the children. We don't want the system to be fragmented anymore. We'd like this to be streamlined, and all the families that get together, there's 14 or so state groups that they need to coordinate, and it's very difficult. And so we're underutilizing some of the dollars that are available from Medicare and other federal systems. So here's just some of the systems that we need to coordinate between, and the families are overwhelmed, and they aren't able to find their way through all of the time. So we'd like this coordination, getting parents access to early intervention, facilitating the timely delivery of available services, make use of the infants and toddlers, early brain development, and coordinate the system as required under the Individuals Act. So we hope to have good assessments and good outcomes, good use of funds and services, and we hope that we can, in fact, make a big difference in the lives of these families. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Nelson. Very, very efficient, very well done. I think I have a question for you, Dr. Nelson, if you can hang on for a second, from Representative Brown.
Yes, it's not a question so much as it's a statement, and I have to thank Representative Flawick for bringing this forward. I don't talk about it much, but I have a 26-year-old son who is hearing impaired, and I tell you what, he grew up in the time when they did not test for hearing loss as an infant, and he was born with this. And as a parent, I talked with my doctor, I talked with my friends and family and tried to get help, and he wasn't even diagnosed until he was 3 years old. And when you think about how much he missed as far as learning to speak, and our communication was very difficult. So I'm just so pleased that this is being brought forward, and I think that we do need to consider some of the other bills too, that it will make the hearing testing mandatory at an infant age, because the signs aren't always recognizable to everyone. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Nelson. We have Randa Sivaraj?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Randa Sivaraja.
Sivaraja. Welcome, Ms. Sivaraja.
I am not here today as an Anoka County Commissioner, but rather as a parent of a child who is deaf, and also as a parent representative on the Universal Newborn Hearing Screening and Early Hearing Detection and Intervention Committee. My son did not have newborn screening at the hospital, and although many times we expressed concern to our pediatrician time after time after time since the time he was 3 months old, saying, you know, something didn't seem right, he wasn't responding to our voices, he wasn't turning, those concerns were virtually ignored, and we were told that, you know, boys are slower, they learn to talk later, my son never talked till he was 2 and a half, and it was really pushed off. And so finally at the age of 2, when we no longer needed a referral to a specialist from our insurance, we brought him to an audiologist, and he was diagnosed with a bilateral profound hearing loss, so in other words, he was deaf. And in spite of my working in a county system, I found it very difficult to identify the resources that were available to my child. Because hearing loss is a low incidence disability, there was no critical mass to provide a quality program within our school district or really anywhere in the state. I really faced a system that was fragmented and frankly ineffective. I don't believe that the school district was necessarily getting the best maybe effects out of the resources that were being put into my child, nor was the insurance company. We had a 3.5-year-old child that was being transported to and from daycare to multiple services throughout the day. He would go to speech therapy twice a week through the school, preschool 4 days a week, teacher of the deaf and hard of hearing once a week. They had an interpreter in preschool with him. For a child who virtually has no language, having a sign language interpreter in there with him, frankly, was not a good use of public dollars. In addition to that, we were driving him down to the University of Minnesota, driving him down to LifeTrack Resources, trying to get him all the services that he needed. However, nothing was working. It was very ineffective. And he would fall asleep in the car and obviously be extremely frustrated when he got there. So unfortunately, this is what families continue to face today. It's a system that is not coordinated and not effective in moving deaf and hard of hearing children to compete successfully with their hearing peers. One of the things that we see is that there is a lack of reliable statistical data regarding children who are deaf and hard of hearing. And there needs to be better coordination between the Department of Health and the Department of Education for children that are identified to receive deaf services. Many of them are being coded as being developmentally disabled. And so there's no tracking, real true tracking. We really don't know how many deaf children are receiving services in Minnesota. There's limited program options around the state. As a parent, I was not told that I had an option of communication choices. If your child was deaf, they must learn how to sign. So after doing a lot of searching, I did find a program that did meet my child's needs and the communication mode that we chose as a family. We need to have the same expectations academically for deaf children as we do for hearing children. And for years I argued that my son should be tested and against his hearing peers because that's where he would need to be able to compete successfully in the hearing world. But time after time I was told by the schools that he should be tested based on deaf norms. Well, when the average deaf person graduating from high school across this nation today is a fourth grade reading level, frankly, as a parent, that wasn't good enough for me. I felt as though we should be setting higher expectations. So I think that one of the things that will happen with this particular position is it will help to coordinate those services because it is such a low incidence disability across the state. School districts really don't know what to do with these children, especially as they're identified much earlier now. So personnel who are in those systems are very dedicated. They're working very hard to do their best. It's just not having the experience and knowledge to be able to really serve these families to the fullest extent possible. So as we're moving from a voluntary system of newborn screening to a mandated system of screening infants at birth for fearing loss, we need to make sure that there's a system put in place that will get families the services they need and support them so that those children can be successful academically and that we have true accountability in the system and that the public dollars are well spent. So thank you so much for your time, and we appreciate your support of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Sivaraja. Wonderful testimony. Other questions? Representative Heidrichen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, being a Lion member, I know the Lions finally got involved in this, and I was I'm honored with the Helen Keller Sight Award. It's one of the few people in the state of Minnesota received it for some of the work I've done with the eye bank and with the cornea transfer and things of this sort. But I'm wondering the amount that Representative Slavik has here, $160,000. You would think that, you know, that the Department of Health and Human Services would be helping as well. But I think I'm thankful that you're bringing this forth, because it's a very, very, I know we've discussed it among the Lions. It's very, very, and I think I'm hoping that we get the Lions even to step forward even bigger than what they have in the past. But it's a very good program, and I think it's time hospitals start doing this. And I really appreciate this.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Ms. Hartnett, why don't you identify yourself for the record? And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hartnett, and I'm with the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearing People. The commission has been working on this issue for over 10 years, and if you look at your handout, you'll see a blue piece of paper. We have a package of services that we're trying to get passed, or bills that we have before you that we're trying to get passed. The first is a screening mandate with an advisory board that has all stakeholders with different communication modes and expertise in different communication modalities and in medical interventions and educational interventions sitting at the table to develop guidelines for the state. Then we have role models for deaf and hard of hearing, persons that I've never met a deaf person, having families come from a place of fear to a place of confidence, knowing that their deaf child can grow up to be one of the many deaf professionals that's in this state. A hearing aid loan bank that was started by the Lions Club, but the Lions are coming forward and asking for help from that. So those are from the Department of Human Services and the parent-to-parent guide, where they're meeting with parents and getting advocacy skills and learning about in an unbiased manner their choice of communication modalities. And then the third and the last, in which we feel is just huge, is this coordinator. It's just coordinating the services is essential. And we have to be providing services according to the IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities and Education Act. We should be using them better, and this will help do that. And we really are thankful for Representative Slavik for coming forward with this legislation.
Are there any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? If not, we have a question from Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's not really a question, but thank you for bringing this forward. I'm one of the children that had to go through this. I'm deaf in an ear, and I can tell you the challenges that it provides to our young children. With a limited vocabulary, probably less than 50% of what I needed when I was young, and then the other 50% of the vocabulary that I did have, I couldn't speak well. I couldn't pronounce my name. I couldn't pronounce my family members' names. And it affects you in every day of your life in school. To try to give me a spelling test was quite the chore, because you can't hear the words right, you can't pronounce, and you can't spell. And it affected me for my entire life, but with proper services. I had a speech therapist through the age of 16. With proper services, a lot can be done. I mean, I just got done speaking in front of 200 people today. And to imagine that when I was 12 or 14 years old was almost unfathomable. So thank you for bringing this forward, and hopefully it will help some people and increase the progression of our young children for speech, for pronunciation, just for being able to recognize syllables and hearing. And I know my story isn't close to the dramatic stories of other people, because I do have another good ear. But thank you for doing that.
Thank you, Representative Haas, for a powerful testimony in your own right on this issue. Are there any other questions? Representative Slavik?
Mr. Chair and members, I want to thank the members for their consideration, Representative Brown and Representative Hosh and Representative Heidkirchen for sharing your stories. I think this really is an issue that affects kids and families. And I have a child who was diagnosed as young with in special education, somewhat hearing related, but sort of spoke his own language. I mean, this whole thing about you have to be able to hear well to know how to talk well. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is very important. We're going to have a lot of competing needs, Mr. Chair and members, but I think this is something we really need to do for the families in Minnesota that are struggling with this and for the kids to get them ahead and get them where they need to be as they grow older and get into school.
Representative Slawik, I wish you well with this. It's a pretty modest request, quite frankly, and so I'm very hopeful. Members, with that, Representative Slawik removes a motion that House File 1887 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee with a further recommendation that it be re-referred to K-12 Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Slawik. Thank you, testifiers. Okay. I'm going to have Representative Dietrich assume the gavel here while we move on to my bill. Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move House File 2085 be recommended to pass and refer to Finance Committee, and it's our desire to have this at K-12 Finance for their consideration in the omnibus bill.
Okay, proceed with your bill.
Madam Chair and members, I will be very, very brief. I've got a number of testifiers who I think are going to do a much better job of painting the picture for you. This is a small grant program for the Summit Academy OIC, their Quantum Opportunities Program. Members, if you don't know about Summit Academy OIC, they've been doing spectacular work for a number of years in the West Metro area, actually Twin Cities area. They've been doing terrific work in the last few years in helping to address one of our big concerns, which is the racial, ethnic, academic achievement gap. Working with a number of young students, we're going to have an opportunity to hear from some of them today in terms of, you know, these are students, members that have tremendous capacity, but, you know, some things aren't quite happening for them, and so they've created a terrific guided program where they bring in a number of different aspects and opportunities for these students to find their self-motivation and then eventually connect these students as they progress with existing programs, many of which we've heard about earlier, to continue to work with them. So, you know, they sort of prepare these students and then hand them off to very good programs that are targeted at getting these students into post-secondary. We're talking about a demographic group of students that in their demographic groups currently has a very low incidence of post-secondary participation. So, members, with that, I'm going to leave it the rest of the testimony to Mr. King, and he'll introduce the rest of the testifiers as well.
Mr. King, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to appear again today. 2 years ago, we were before this committee, and you approved the Quantum Opportunities Program for 2 years of funding. I'm back with good news. I have two young men here with me today that you've helped bring their GPAs up from below 2.0 to now where one is actually on the being invited to the National Honor Society. As you may recall, I was a school board member in Minneapolis approximately 8 or 9 years ago. I was extremely frustrated with the incidence of African-American kids failing the basic standards test, America's a test-taking country. We went out and found the Quantum Opportunities Program, which has been researched by RAND. We replicated it and recently implemented it at North High. And I'm going to bring forward Mike Favor, the principal of North High, to talk to you about the dynamic partnership that we have there and about the work that our young people are doing and why it's important that we continue this work and also look to expand it to lower grades so that the kids can come to high school actually ready to compete and ready for the world.
Mm-hmm.
Thank
Mr. Faber, welcome. Please identify yourself for the tape.
I'm Mike Faber, principal at Minneapolis North Community High School. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm excited about this because at North Community High School, our largest feeder schools to North Community High School is people who are new to the state. So with that, some of the expectations that we have in Minneapolis public schools, not a lot of parents have that foundation as students are coming in. This program allows us to address some of those needs so that all students that are coming in can meet that expectation for an academic achievement. It's great to hear this message, not just coming from the schools, but our business partners, our community partners as well. So we're using data to drive instruction. And one of the exciting things about this is we're sharing data on our kids. So much like we go to the doctor's office and they draw your blood, we kind of give a test initially so that we can better understand where students are deficient and areas that need to improve so that we can increase academic performance.
Mr. Faber, would you like to introduce the voice, or are we going to go back to Mr. King?
Madam Chair, I'll introduce Mr. Denzel Allen and Mr. Jonathan Ross, two second-year quantum opportunity students.
Mr. Allen and Mr. Ross, welcome to the board. I have had many conversations with Mr. King about this program, and I am so excited to finally see the product. I can tell he is very proud, and actually so are we. Very proud of you. Would you like to speak?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me have a chance to speak on behalf of the Quantum Opportunities Program. And I would just like you guys to know that they've helped me out a really lot since when I first started coming in off. In the beginning, my first progress reports, my grades weren't looking too well because I ended up procrastinating where I didn't understand the stuff and I didn't get enough help in class. And I always had something doing after school, so I ended up not finishing it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was from homework. And all kinds of things. I had my grades pretty low. I had about 1A in my freshman year. And my friend ended up telling me about the CLAP program. He was like, "Well, I go to this program and they end up, they'll feed you." And I went about 2 days and I started to really enjoy it, and I've been sticking with it since my freshman year since then, and since then my grades have been rising up. Been on A or B honor roll about every time since then. I've had no D's or F's, so I've always made it to the rewards that Mr. Booster gave to people in the CA program with no D's or F's. My grades dropped a little bit because I missed a couple of days from being sick, but CLAP still helped me get them back up. They used to be F's, they're about C's now, and I'm still trying to get them up even higher than that. My grade point average is about over 3.2, so because they recommended me for the National Honor Society. And I already wrote the essay, I just have to get my parents to sign the paper, and I should be in it soon. But, it's some boring thing. They also do things with you over the summer. They take you places, we did community programs over the summer, and we also did things that were just fun. If you did enough of community or educational things in the end, you'd be able to go to, they took us to Valley Fair in the end. And over this year, they've been recently doing things with, businesses, all kinds of job opportunities. They'll bring people in, in the first week, they did things with law, so they brought a couple lawyers in. Mm-hmm. This week, this month, they've been doing things more with business, and we've been doing things like planning our own businesses. And today, in fact, we're going to have a guy who actually, makes business come down and look at some of our businesses. But CLAP has been a really important thing to me over the years, and I really hope that you guys will accept this bill to keep it going.
Thank you very much. And just for my own purposes, you were Mr. Ross, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Ross. Mr. Allen, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to be here to speak on behalf of the Quantum Opportunities Program. My name is Denzel Allen, and I do go to North High School. And ways that the Quantum Opportunities Program has helped me out is because when I first started high school last year, I had a 1.2 GPA. That's excessively low as far as I'm concerned. And my friend Phillip, he told me about the program because me and him talk all the time. And one day he noticed my grades were low, and he just told me about it and said that they could help me out. And I started to go there a lot, and I really appreciated how the staff consistently motivated you, and they always talk to your teachers on a consistent basis. And if you don't understand a certain subject, like last year I didn't understand algebra that good, so one of the workers that helps us, Nick Ray, he used to talk to me all the time about this is how you do this or that, and if you don't understand it, they will continue to help you out until you fully understand it. And right now I have a 3.24 GPA from a 1.2. And some things that I like about the Quantum Opportunity is, as Jonathan said, we've had a lot of lawyers or people from the police district come and talk to us to keep us interested. They do activities such as bowling, Valley Fair, or we'll go swimming during the summer and breaks like Thanksgiving, for instance. They help us practice for our MBST tests or ACT and SATs. They give us dates for the ACT tests. And one thing that I really like is that these people are not trying to be your friend. They're trying to help you get your grades up. And if you come, you will notice that if you're not staying on track or if you're not doing your work, they'll just tell you to leave because they don't have time to try to help somebody that's not even committed to the program. That's one thing I really like, because they used to do that to me last year. I know too well. Because I used to always not want to do my algebra, and sometimes they would tell me, like, well, if you don't do it, then we're going to have to make you leave. And eventually, I started doing my algebra. I have a B+ in algebra now in geometry.
Oh, cool.
So I did learn. And it's not social hour. I mean, if you talk the whole time with your friends, yes, they will tell you to leave because you're there to do your work. You're not there to talk to your friends or be on your phone or listen to your music all hour. So those are some things about the Quantum Opportunity that I really appreciate.
Wow. I just have to say that you two young men have really inspired me this morning, and I want to thank you. Thank you for coming.
You're welcome.
Mr. King.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much. As you can see, our young people put the work in, and as the handout shows you, the program works for kids who do work. I'm most optimistic because you can see on the second page of your handout, improved attendance for these young people improved by 32%. On average, and when they show up for high school without the proper skills, they get very discouraged, and that's how we end up with dropouts who later end up in the criminal justice system or on welfare. And these young men, as you can see, are on their way to becoming productive citizens. Thank you very much for your support, and please help me convince young Mr. Denzel here that it's Morehouse College. He should attend, not Michigan State. Thank you so much.
We have a question. Representative Hedgerton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's always good to see Mr. King, and I've always enjoyed the discussions we had with Summit. That we've had these meetings, I think, the last 4 years, and they've been in my office a good number of times, and it's always hard to get rid of you because it's interesting what you're doing. And Representative Mariani, we've had a lot of good discussions with some of the good programs going on, and I've often modeled some of my ideas and what we should be doing in all of our schools of creating jobs, interest in jobs. I'm an old former debate coach and speech coach, and I've judged state speech term a number of times. And Mr. Allen, I gave you an A- in your presentation. You did a nice job. Very nice job. Mr. Ross, you got an A because you had better eye contact. All right? Either way, I'll get the other way around. But anyways, very good jobs. But it was nice to see your enthusiasm when we talk, the enthusiasm about talking about school. And that's what we need to hear and see in all of our students, not just our college-bound students, all of our students in the state of Minnesota, to get them a job that they really like and in school to find things that you like that you may like after you're out of school. And I love your presentation, and of course I love your program. I think we need more of that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hosh.
I'll try to make this quick, Madam Chair, but thank you for coming today. And Mr. Allen and Mr. Ross, very good job presenting. And I will remember your testimony. And one of the requests that I'd like to know is if it would be possible, if you could write down the members that are here today and maybe in the future give us an update at where you're at. Oftentimes we talk about investments here. And sometimes we like to play political games. Some people want to say the word investment means tax increases or whatnot. But I would love to see where you are in the future because, you know what, By investing in programs like this and making sure that our young children have the resources and the access and the motivation to do well is going to save us money in the long run, because I bet you're going to be an asset to our community in the future. You already are today, but even more so in the future. And it'd be great to see that update, because I'll remember your testimony today. And if, Mr. King, if you were to tell us where Mr. Ross or Mr. Allen are 3 or 4 years from now, I would remember today, and I think that would be something that I would be interested in, maybe some of the other members here.
Thank you, Representative Hosh, well said, and I would ditto what he just said. That would be wonderful if you wouldn't mind keeping us updated. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also am thinking that this has to be a wonderful program, particularly in light of, you know, the discussion around North High, and this seems to be one of the solutions rather than some of the criticisms, and I think that's really important. I'm wondering, and this is probably for Chair Mariani, is there any way that they can take advantage of the supplemental funding from No Child Left Behind, or this particular nonprofit, as one of the vendors and get some funding?
Madam Chair, one of the issues that we face around some of the supplemental funding, believe it or not, North High School, we did extremely well in that, in reading, and we made adequate yearly progress. And because we made adequate yearly progress, the funding's not available. I need to say this, and I just want to make sure I say this. Mr. King has helped me transform my building. There's a different language. I don't know if anyone's been in a high school lately, but there is truly a different language taking place in the building because of some of the work that these young people are doing and because of some of the work that Mr. King and his staff are truly committed to doing. So I want to make sure I say that publicly and for the record, that we are transforming that building, and I encourage and invite you all to come out and take a look at what we're doing. I think one of the things that, with Mr. King's help, we're looking at extending our year as well and making it mandatory that every child in the building takes at least one AP course throughout their high school career for college ready and job readiness. So we're pushing the envelope at North along with Mr. King's support, and this supports that learning.
Thank you, Representative Erickson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and good to see you, gentlemen. And, you know, I'm proud to say that it was under our majority that we got this program going, and thanks to Representative Quinzing, former Representative Quinzing, that we could get this going. So thank you, Representative Mariani, for continuing this. But I want to ask Representative Mariani about the policy issues we should be debating, because that has to do with the reports. And so, Representative Mariani, would you comment on those, and then maybe, Mr. King, you could follow up with to what extent these reports will convince us that this should be probably ongoing funding. But maybe Representative Mariani first, because there is policy change in here. Representative
Mariani,
this is good information.
Madam Chair, members, I think it's certainly appropriate for us to be looking at reports. I know Mr. King alluded quickly to some, but I think we should certainly be looking for further information from the program, and we could spend time going through that. I think it is important for us to learn from the best practices that are emerging with programs like this, particularly as our schools continue to diversify. Unfortunately, I don't have the report before me, so I can't comment on the policy implications, but I think our committee should certainly and will be looking at any future policy implications for this kind of work.
Mr. King, did you want to comment?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we firmly believe that you have to have data in real time in order to, A, learn from your mistakes and also to build on progress. We share on a daily basis information with the school teachers in real time by using something called Teacher Eat. So Denzel's attendance, his test scores, his homework, et cetera, are available to my people on a daily basis. In turn, they manage a scorecard, which senior management views on a monthly basis, and then reports to the board on a quarterly basis for our accountability purposes. So the quantitative progress of the young people, as well as the quality and how they're behaving in school. finally, in our bill, we propose to report on a semi-annual basis to the commissioners, demonstrating that young people are making academic progress. As you can imagine, it's pretty dismal when you have a 0.8 GPA, but we can tell you that you doubled it at a 1.6. And then the world opens up for you once you move past a 2.0. Further, tracking their attendance, which has a monetary value to the school, but you can't learn if you're not there. Once again, you'll be able to see in our structure reports that these young people are actually coming to school and their graduation rates and test scores. We like to be able to demonstrate that we are adding value to Mr. Favor and the children at that school, because there are many people competing to come in and do the job, and we think that data is the actual way to do it. And then finally, I think it was very important that we do close the loop back with you, which is why I brought two young people forward. Hopefully, I'll still be around, and certainly, though, it is our intent to let you know the actual graduation rates and college attendance, whether that's technical school, two-year school, or four-year institutions for the young people. So you can look to see those reports, and we will also ensure that you personally, the members of the committee, are on our mailing list and that you get it sent directly to you.
Thank you. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just want to, the two young men here, you know, we had already mentioned that Representative Hush and mentioned to get back to us in a few years, but what's even more important is that you get back someday, write a letter to your teachers after 4 or 5 years down the line and let them know how you're doing. I've been in education for several years, and when I get a letter from one of my students that now is successful in what they're doing in life, that means a lot to me, so I'm sure it would to your teachers too.
Thank you. Representative Boyd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Wonderful testimony. Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Allen, what grade are you in right now?
10th grade.
So you're 10th grade right now? And Mr. Ross, what are you?
I'm 10th grade as well, sir.
You both in there? And you don't have to call me sir. Just, that's you. But that, you know, that tells a lot about you gentlemen, very much. And it's so impressive. And I just wanted to say, I had the opportunity to visit Patrick Henry this week. We've all been offered the opportunity to go to schools, and I went to Patrick Henry. Some other friends of ours set it up for us. I would love to come to your school and see this. And I know I'm going to an elementary school next week to observe that, and I encourage my colleagues to take that opportunity to do that, because especially being from rural Minnesota, you know, just outside Minnesota, just to go and see what opportunities and what is happening with all of our children throughout the state. As we're sitting here trying to make decisions on education, I'm just so encouraging all of us to take that step and do that. So I hope that I have the opportunity to come and see you gentlemen. Not necessarily you two in the middle, but you two in the end for sure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Mariani, did you want to have any closing comments?
Madam Chair, you may want to ask if anyone wants to testify in the audience.
Oh, yes. Anybody in the audience want to testify? Thank you. Okay, Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, just very quickly, one is I do want to acknowledge Mr. Faber's presence here. In my organization, Minnesota Minority Education Partnership, we actually featured his high school precisely for the issues that he talked about in terms of incredible change and forward progress that's happening at that school. Members, it's a terrific program. I hope that we'll have ability to put this before the Central Finance Committee to have it included and continue the funding that Representative Erickson and her colleagues and of course, you know, our side of the aisle, we're supportive of that as well.
Absolutely.
In the last 2 years, but we do appreciate your leadership with that, Representative Erickson. So with that, Madam Chair, members, I'd renew my motion that House File 2085 be recommended to pass, refer to Finance Committee with a re-referral to the K-12 Finance Committee.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion passes. Yes. Representative Anzels, would you like to move to the table with your testifiers?
I'll cover for you here. Indicate your hands.
House File 1092, Online Learning Option Act Modified. The chair moves that House File 1092 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the K-12 Finance Division. With that, Representative Anzels, would you like to identify yourself for the tape and begin your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is House File 1092, and I believe I'm joined by my testifiers. I'll make a few preliminary comments regarding the delete all amendment that I believe is being passed out.
Representative Anzels, I am going to go ahead and move the delete all amendment. It is A070348. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Briefly, I know many of you are wondering why an old fossil like me, who was last in a classroom in 1980, is worried about online learning, or not necessarily worried about online learning, but is even introducing language dealing with the subject. Well, the truth of the matter is, I represent 8 great school districts, rural, all in declining enrollment, all struggling. You've heard the refrain many, many times over and over again. And I spend a great deal of time with my boards of education and school superintendents just like you. And the topic of online learning comes up in all of our conversations. I want to be very, very clear that this legislation is not intending to destroy online learning. It is simply designed to make some modest modifications that kids and parents, school superintendents and school boards and teachers and the providers of this service can all find some common ground on. This legislation has been a work in progress. Several of the stakeholders are involved and will continue to be involved. And with that, I'll turn it over to the Superintendent of Schools with the International Falls District, Don Langan. He's here again, Chair Greiley.
I see that.
So I'll turn it over to Mr. Lang.
Thank you, Representative Anzels. Mr. Lang, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Don Lang, Superintendent of Schools, ISD 361, International Falls, Minnesota.
Welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair and committee, to speak in support of House File 1092. I think that the comments that I would wish to make for your consideration is perhaps to provide, at least from my view as a school superintendent, some context for online learning as perhaps the latest phenomenon in the realm of school choice. First of all, when I first became a school superintendent in the state of Minnesota, even though this is my home state, Howard Casey was your commissioner and Al Quie was your governor. Now that's about 27 years ago. During that time, as a school superintendent and almost totally serving rural school districts in northern Minnesota, I have been party to things such as the Post-Secondary Enrollment Options Act, charter school phenomenon, home schools, open enrollment, and online learning. It is very difficult as a school superintendent who has spent 34 years in school administration and 42 years in this business to argue against the vision and the philosophy of school choice. That is an almost unassailable proposition. I know that I have been with my colleagues when we stand in a corner and stamp our feet and whine and cry and watch the ADMs go out our front door. But I think it boils down to a larger issue. To look at the school choice context right now, of which online learning is a part, I think that we can characterize a number of school choice public policy decisions as decisions that basically affected the institutional engagements of public schools. With PSEO, we became engaged with our post-secondary providers. With open enrollment, we became engaged with our sister and brother school districts. But these were organizational complexities that I think that we've been able to work through, and in my judgment, in the main, for the better opportunity for students in Minnesota. I think that online learning, with its reliance on technology, with its ability to both deliver instruction in an asynchronous and synchronous manner, I would probably have to declare that online learning could be one of the most impacting phenomenon that we've had as far as public education, because it deals both with organizational complexity integration as well as programmatic. And that is different. It is extremely different. I think that if there has been an error, and I will claim that error as much as anyone else, it's not been in our vision or in our intention in terms of public policy. It's been perhaps in our failure to recognize, define, understand, and ultimately to predict what the systemic impacts are of these public policies. I'm very aware that House File 1092 can have consequences for other current law, other current public policy, and certainly engage some very active debate. And that is said with a hope and not with a fear. The issues of the public policy that I think that I would like to see avoided in the future, take for example PSEO, Post-Secondary Enrollment Options Act. That was the philosophy, was to provide curricular enhancement and enrichment of high academic quality for students who could not in other manners access it. That's what we did. I'm wondering what PSEO inadvertently has done for struggling AP programs, struggling international baccalaureate programs, college in the schools programs. Has PSEO, with its opportunity for a migration to campus, has that abetted and aided the development of these other academic programs, or has it been perhaps a deterrent? I think the jury is still out on that. Or as we used to say, the data are not quite in. With regard to open enrollment, an excellent concept. I don't think that anyone would ever have predicted that open enrollment could actually, in some cases, end up with free agency for athletics. And yet we know that that is an issue, and we're dealing with that. With online learning, what effect does it have to mix program and institutional responsibilities when a student can, under current law, enroll full-time with an online provider and still remain my responsibility in my school district as a school superintendent? I'm not sure that was an intended effect. I don't have to explain to this committee, Mr. Chairman, the issues that that can create. I think that what I would recommend for consideration is that House File 1092 can seek to reestablish the engagement of the parties rather than enhancing what has become the diversity of us in this business of education. Mr. John Voss, fellow over here on my left, directs Northern Star Online, a large consortium in the western suburbs. I found Mr. Voss to be not only an intelligent and thoughtful colleague in working with 1092 in its several iterations. John, you owe me lunch on that one. But what it has done, it is defined for me as one of your school superintendents, that if in fact there are issues with the current online learning statute, what would be wrong with engaging that dialogue with the parties? I'm talking high school principals, school superintendents, online providers, in seeking to make this work well for everyone rather than creating the negative effects that it is currently doing. This is not negative effects necessarily for kids, but it is having negative effects on your organizational structures in the state. Right now I've got about 86 student courses this semester with online learning. And they are so diverse, terribly diverse. As a school superintendent, when I graduate these kids on May 31st and say that every one of these youngsters have met or exceeded the standards required for high school diploma, as established by the state of Minnesota and ISD 361, quite frankly, I will bite my tongue. That is not an acceptable state of affairs. To decry the opportunity for a kid to take an online learning course that is needed because of that student's circumstances or because of that student's academic desires and needs, to deny that would be wrong. To provide choice without guidance as an educator is wrong. What we're looking to try to do is 1092. Is build in the necessary dialogue for guided choice. I'm a partner with these kids. And in most cases, too many cases, every time we talk school choice, a resident public school and that superintendent becomes the adversary in the dialogue. I've had 42 years of this. Like I told my colleagues in the back of the room, I don't know how many times I want to ride my horse down here. It's time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Langan.
Thank you.
Of course, we do enjoy when you come and ride your horse down here. Thank you. Thank you for framing this issue up for us very comprehensively and for sharing with us, hoping that we'll get a deeper appreciation of the challenges faced by school districts in this regard. Representative Ansel.
Mr. Chair and members, before I turn it over to John Voss, our designated online provider, I was remiss in not informing the committee that the department has also been a party to our discussions and our work, and they will continue to be at the table as well. So with that, I'll turn it over to John Voss.
Welcome, Mr. Voss. Please state your name for the record.
Name is John Voss. I'm the supervisor of the Northern Star Online Consortium, which includes 13 member districts in the western suburbs of the metro area and also Northeast Metro Intermediate 916, which includes 11 school districts in the northeastern section suburbs of St. Paul. Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee, and thanks also to Dr. Langan for involving us in the discussion. He did raise some of these issues last year, and I think our, in some instances, we dropped the ball in not picking up right on at that time last year and addressing it. And so We're glad that he's been willing to work with us to figure out a way to address his concerns, and also, as he says, to not destroy the online learning system as it's come to develop. The original vision with online was to provide alternative learning options for students that incorporated 21st century language skills, and also to extend the principle of student choice. The impact on the local district, though, has raised concerns at that level, and we've dealt with that in our consortium. Most of our members are both providers and enrollers of students in the online programs, and so they have a lot of the same concerns about what happens when a student tries to take all of their load online. We've been able to work through some of that as a collaborative amongst our members. It does seem now that, in a larger sense, we've moved to a new stage of online learning, version 2.0 or whatever we want to call it, where we need to support partnerships between local schools and online providers rather than to put them at odds. More people understand the value of online learning for students. They know that students are going to encounter these similar experiences in college and in the workplace. And so it's supported at the local level, but there is a lot of concern for some of the adverse effects that it has at the local level. So as a provider, we're willing to accept the requirements for more clarity and transparency in our course offerings that are indicated in certain parts of the amended bill here. Although we do hope it's recognized that this is a higher bar than school districts are required to clear in terms of sharing information. But because it is the local districts that are granting the credit, we're willing to accept that provision and provide the information that they need. We also understand that the impact that this is having on local schools needs to be respected and softened to whatever extent is possible. So we have worked with Dr. Langan to address his concerns and agree on some viable solutions. We figure that this conversation will need to continue. There are some things that are probably not addressed entirely to the satisfaction of any of us, but right now we think we've found common ground for now that we can build on, as he said, including in the future high school principals, the Department of Education, Ed Minnesota, the Rural Education Association. There are a lot of affected parties that probably need to be involved in a statewide system for coordinating the supplemental online learning that transfers credit from one provider to a local school district. But we still do support a student's right to choose learning alternatives that coincide with their learning styles, their needs for more flexible scheduling, all of the reasons that students take online courses, their interest in unique courses, whether it's Chinese or AP classes that maybe are not available in every district. But I believe our compromised version continues to offer students that choice and the opportunity, but attaches some responsibility and some clarity to the process for students, the parents, the local schools, and the online providers.
Thank you, Mr. Voss. Are there any questions for the gentleman? Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is the issue that I was told about up there at St. John's with a group of teachers, and I'm glad to see everybody's working this out, and we got some legislation to cover it. I could probably should be a co-author on this bill.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Mr. Voss, have your discussions involved parents and students at all, since, you know, they are highly involved in this also, as you've tried to work out these changes, and what have they said, if anything?
Mr. Voss.
Thank you. It depends on, I think, whether what the students are looking for is a replacement for something during their regular day or in addition to what they take at the school level. Probably the one thing that a lot of parents and students are interested in is a way for students to take courses beyond their full load,
right,
and still have that be state-funded.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are alternatives for that if you qualify as an at-risk student or if you're in special ed or some other gifted programs. But for parents and students, that's probably the biggest concern is there a way to accelerate without having to pay tuition at the local level? For the most part, parents and students are interested in more opportunities, and concerned with online in the respect of what kind of social interaction are students going to have with their peers if they're taking classes online.
Mr. Chair.
Have we, from the department, received a report on online learning since we began this? I've read so many reports from the department lately. I can't remember if we got one on that.
Representative Erickson, I was going to ask the department for comments, and I, like you, I've received a lot of reports that are still waiting to be read at this point. They will be read. Perhaps we could ask someone from the department to come and speak to this issue. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Gloria Kibble. I am the interim director in the Division of School Choice Programs and Services, and I would also like to have my online learning specialist introduce herself.
I'm Karen Johnson, educational specialist with the Department of Education.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson has posed a question in terms of any kind of report or evaluations or assessments that are current in regards to this issue.
Well, I think it was in July of 2005.
This is Ms. Johnson.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. July of 2005, in Subdivision 7 of the Online Learning Options Act, there's an Online Learning Advisory Council that has taken up these issues. They have met four times over this last year, and they do not have a report at this time.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
So, Ms. Johnson, is there one forthcoming, or does the council think they need to collect more data?
Ms. Johnson or Ms. Kibble?
We actually have Ms. the Johnson. Advisory Council Chair here today.
Come on down.
Come on down.
Join the crowd.
Well, she's coming down. Then Gloria Kibble. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, data is always very good, and we have certainly over the years looked at what we can do with data, and the department collects some pieces of information through our MIRES reporting. For example, how many students are taking enrolled. One of the other pieces we need to look at is how many courses they're enrolled in. But we are looking at, and we have looked at some programs as far as what the relationship is between what the students enroll in and then how successful they've been. But I'm going to let Jessica Wiley address that.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you. I'm Jessica Wiley. I'm the chair of the Online Learning Advisory Council, and I'm also the director of educational services for Northeast Metro 916. Intermediate School District. And the question.
Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, would you comment on what the Advisory Council, what conclusions you're coming to as you meet, and will this bill, conform to the changes that you think are needed, and maybe the department needs to answer that more accurately?
The Online Learning Advisory. Jessica Wiley, thank you. The Online Learning Advisory has 12 members. We've met, as Karen mentioned, four times. Basically, our charge was to look at the seven areas of the Online Learning Act, which include program quality, quality assurance, program design, special education. And we've, in those four meetings, really looked heavily at quality assurance and program design. We've looked at the legislation that was being proposed and discussed that at our March 21st, February 21st meeting. We also are, what we're really interested in is engaging a statewide conversation on the big issues. I think that Don Langan said it very well when you talked about the impact organizational issues and how complex they are. Online learning is a curriculum and instructional delivery system, but it's that part of it, yes, it's another way of looking at curriculum, but it has huge organizational issues with how kids get their credit and how it's funded. So as an advisory, we're really looking at how the state can engage in those big questions. We're looking, have been actively talking with Ryan Winkler about his technology bill also.
Ms. Riley, I am encouraged to hear that latter interest and focus of the advisory committee in terms of the issues that Dr. Langan has raised for us here today, and also hearing you articulate a concern over the organizational impacts that Dr. Langan has laid out. Can you tell us what kind of a timeline or time frame the committee is considering in terms of this kind of review and dialogue?
Well, we were legislated for 3 years. I believe we have until March of 2008, June of 2008, to make recommendations to the commissioner, and that's what our charge was to give recommendations to the commissioner. If there's a report, it wasn't in the specific description of the advisory, but certainly we would articulate what we're recommending.
And Ms. Riley, the report to the commissioner, you talked about quality assurance program design issues, which of course are interrelated here and important, but is it your understanding that the report then is directing you to be able to respond comprehensively to the organizational issues that have been raised here this afternoon?
I think that the committee is working, the advisory is working towards that. You know, in 4 meetings, we've taken time to come to some clarity about definitions, what even just in the last week, defining what a supplemental program is versus a full-time program, taking a look at all of those kinds of definitions that are all new, and then taking a look at what is our responsibility in terms of the design of our standards included and all of those kinds of program design that every school district has. So in the 4 meetings, we've come to, I think, an understanding and agreement of that we're all talking on the same page, and now we're ready to take a look at how do we have a partnership with school districts and have a comprehensive look at the whole system.
Representative Erdahl and Representative Grayling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm kind of running back and forth with another committee, so I might have, hopefully didn't miss this, but in conversation with the principal of the school that I used to teach in, he had some concerns about online learning, particularly how it relates to the criteria as far as those taking it. They're having some problems with people that he felt were not, you know, should not have been taking these courses, who were then flunking and then coming back and going into his classrooms, his system, and you know, they're having to make adjustments because of that. I see on line, you know, 267 talks about application and notification procedures. I mean, is there I'm sure there must be some particular type of criteria that is established as to who can take these? Do you have to be at a certain rank in your class or grade point average or something or anything? Anybody?
Well, Jessica Wiley, I can begin to answer that. I think Karen is really the specialist to answer those questions. But any student can take an online learning course. There's a number of ways that they're provided. An independent school district has some of their own online learning, and in that case, it's part of their school system. So they're delivering online courses just within their social studies, math, science department. And so they have a relationship with that child as part of their school district. There are providers that, as in the case of Northern Star Online, which John Voss was mentioning, where the student takes from an entity that's not part of the school district. In that case, the provider, in the case of Northern Star Online, they have counselors that talk with the counselors at the school or can talk with the parents or the kids. But again, as in any school district, those kinds of decisions of how that is staffed and what kind of services they offer are dependent on the provider.
Representative Grayling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you say, I know the report is coming out, you're working on the task force, and we have other bills as well, but is the bill before us as amended a good first step in line with where you're going?
Great question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Roy Kibble, I would like to just address a couple of things. As I believe it was Mr. Langan mentioned, we've done a great job. They have done a great job of including the department in the conversation regarding online learning so we could look at it from a statute perspective and what we see as a needs. However, we did just receive the amendment that's in front of us, and they're requesting that there be more time to work on it because we do see some inconsistencies with the amendment. With the online 1.22, it defines what a full-time student is, doesn't mention open enrollment, and then when you move to line, starting on line 2.10, it does talk about open enrollment. The problem is that about a third of our charter school, about a third of our online programs are charter schools, and charter schools are not subject to open enrollment. So we've got some inconsistency here, and the result could be that the providers that are not charter schools will have one set of laws, and the charter schools will have another set because they're not subject to open enrollment. And we would like the opportunity to work through that and talk through so that the bill is consistent with the charter school needs are. Additionally, if you look at the 50% that after a student reaches 50% of their courses, they are then become a full-time student, basically at the provider. This will compound the issue because there will be more students than won't be considered full-time and will be subject to open enrollment. So there are a couple with the inconsistencies that we would like to talk about, including the last one, and that is just PSEO. It's always helpful when the PSEO law and the charter school, or I'm sorry, the PSEO and the online learning, and the open enrollment all work together, and they don't have different standards and different requirements.
Oops, I'm violating.
Chair, I know we're getting out of here, because I need to be in your chair. Yes, you do.
Actually, 20 minutes. So.
Oh, it's...
Yeah, a little bit more time then.
Oh, my calendar says 2 o'clock. It's 2:30.
2:15, I believe.
2:15.
I'll take 2:30, though.
Right. Yeah. Okay, well, anyway, I would like to hear the same question from Ms. Wiley, and then hopefully Representative Giles will keep in touch with everybody as we go forward.
That's right, Wiley.
We've done a lot of work on trying to find language that helps the school districts feel comfortable with what's going on, and the online learning providers. I think those conversations have involved people from the NOLA, which John didn't mention that, but that's the group of providers, the Minnesota Online Learning Association, and with senators and representatives that Don Lanning has put together. And I do think that the language, that there still needs to be conversation about the language, but at this point, we're really happy with where we've gotten. I guess.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Ansels, I take it that you've been working awfully hard on this, and so have the interested parties. I take it that commitment will continue assuming this bill makes it through this committee and moves forward. I frankly would like us not to stop at this point and to keep this going forward, particularly because we have good faith efforts from folks who have, you know, potentially could be in pretty adversarial positions. It's pretty rare in the legislature, quite frankly, when you have that spirit of good faith and cooperation. And so I hope that this will continue, members. But Representative Ansels, do I have your word that we will continue to work with all the interested parties and to address some of these issues that have been raised the last few minutes?
Thank you for your very nice comments, Mr. Chairman. The answer is yes. I just want everybody to know that this is very hard work.
is there anyone else who wishes to testify on the bill? Are there any other questions? If not, then was it Representative Dietrich? It was your motion, I believe. Do you want to renew your motion then? Representative Dietrich renews her motion that House File 1092, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to Finance Committee with our recommendation that it be referred to the K-12 Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Ansels.
Thank you.
Thank you for the testifiers. Thank you, Dr. Langan, for riding your horse down here this morning.
You bet.
Oh. The notes? Oh. Representative Erickson, House File 2023.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And committee, I'd like to move House File 2023,
recommend that it pass and be referred to finance and re-referred then to K-12 finance.
Thank you. Hold on a second. Thank you. Representative Erickson moves that House File 2023 be recommended to pass, referred to finance with a re-referral to K-12 finance. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I apologize for not having any testifiers, but this was a little late notice. If this advances, I will have some middle school folks here to talk about my bill today, which is calling for an advisory task force to look at redesign of the middle school. I have had an interest in this actually since the concept of middle school began. I mean, middle school is one thing, but the concept of middle school is another. And I began my career at the 7th and 8th grade level, and then I returned to 7th and 8th grade level in about the middle of my career, at about the time that it was changing to the middle school concept. And then as a high school teacher, in between those two points, realized that we have some work to do if we are indeed going to make sure that our middle school students are ready for high school, that they're engaged learners. These are the hardwired young people of today. And you will notice in the recommendations that I make for the advisory task force that they look at a lot of different issues surrounding our middle school students, our middle school age, what we would call young adolescents. So with that, Mr. Chair, I don't know if I need to go through the detail other than the fact that I do have a wide array of folks I'd like the commissioner to appoint to this advisory task force. I think their input would be invaluable, and it does include school counselors and parents, two of the groups to which we have been addressing a lot of our issues this session. I do have a couple of handouts. If the pages would pass those out, please. These two handouts are actually from the Department of Education. I've been working them with them on this issue. And one is showing us just what's happening in reading. And when you get this before you, you will see a decline in the bar graphs from 3rd grade to 10th grade. But where we really start to see the decline is in that 7th and 8th grade level. And this is in regard to the MCA2s. This is from a November report by the Department of Education. And then I also provided for you a gender and grade chart. This is the black and white that I'm referring to now. And again, I am concerned that our young adolescent boys are falling behind in the 7th and 8th grade levels. I used to notice that when the young men came to me as 9th graders, whether they were in my honors English class or in my regular English class, they were not quite ready for at least the rigor I was going to expect of them. They were, a little afraid to begin with, and then became very comfortable as they realized that my reason for expecting a lot from them was that I just was there to improve them. And so we worked together very well. But that gap that I noticed, and middle school is different from middle school concepts, so I think it's maybe time that we take a look at this. The other colored chart is also from the department, and grateful for their putting this together for me late last night. But what it does, if you look at the color, you will notice that the last section of every graph is getting smaller as we get to the highest grade level that shows in this chart of testing, and that's the 7th grade level. So that blue bar becomes less wide as we get to the higher grade. That's that middle school level. And for those young adolescents, I would hope that maybe we would consider taking a look at a closer look, like we are at high school, doing the things that I have set out as minimals for the advisory task force to look at. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. When I looked at your bill quickly a little while ago, I was taken by perhaps the same
concerns that you've expressed, and of course many of us probably read last year, the I think it was Newsweek, had a front page or their cover covering these grades and focusing on males in particular. And I can tell you, having raising a 20-year-old male, that I have certainly seen this pattern just with him, that things started looking pretty different right around 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. I know that some of the research out there is encouraging us to look more at these grade levels. Of course, you know, the last few years we've been focused increasingly on high school, which is appropriate, and of course early childhood, but it is a continuum. There is a pathway here, and there's certainly, my read, plenty of research that tells us that these are pivotal years, not just academically, but of course, you know, the whole development of young men and women during this period of time. Are there any questions for Representative Erickson? Representative Peterson, Representative Heidgerken, Representative Slocum. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson, in the first part in Section 1, you have some of the criteria listed, and I think they're all good and that they're things that certainly are important, but one of the most important things are the instructors themselves, the teachers, etc. And I don't see anything in there about incentives or needs to attract people into teaching in that particular area, and also the professional development that will be needed, I think, to enhance at least methods, delivery, etc., delivery of curriculum, etc., in that grade level. And I think that might be something that would be good to have as a piece in there, because the most important person in working at that level are the teachers, because that's in the relationships. I think at that level, relationships are particularly important. And second one that I would comment on is the members of the advisory task force. I'm surprised that I'm advocating for the principals, but I am. I think that they need to be on there. I shouldn't be surprised, but they do need to be on there, I think, as a group. The principals, at least a representative of the principals, would be a secondary principals association. And I'm going to also say a representative from Education Minnesota. So I would suggest those two pieces before it moves on. Thank you.
Representative Peterson, we do have Minnesota Ed. I'm sorry, we do have the school principals.
Where are they? They are on there. Well, but that's different than the a formal representative from the principals, secondary principals association, which I think, I think it's good to have both. And I don't know if Ms. Erickson wants to comment on my two suggestions. I would appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Peterson. Well, this is just a starting list, so absolutely. We want to consider teachers. I've obviously put the student first, but I think mixed in with what happens with the student is definitely the teacher, because, of course, the most important person in the classroom is the teacher. In my point number two, my second clause, I do maximize the relationships between teachers and young adolescent students. So, you know, I think I've covered relationships and I've covered teachers there. But certainly, if this bill moves along, we could specifically address the issue of teacher development, teacher strategies that could be used. I just focused on the student, and I think you can tell from this narrative that I was focusing on the student. But, of course, the teacher is very important.
And Representative Erickson, you do have on line 0.13, maximizing the relationship between teachers and young adolescent students. But
yes,
I think the further recommendation here is to look at recruitment and professional development issues as a part of that. Representative Heidgerken.
Representative Houston covered it.
Terrific. Representative Slocum.
Just a couple of things. I have to say I like this. I'm a 7th, 8th grade teacher, too. And just one little part of it kind of troubles me. 111, line 111. I guess I don't feel there is one formula for all students. to go through middle school within this within that framework. I'd like to see options for middle school structure so that kids have a spectrum and the child and the parent can decide what option works best for that student. And then my other comment was, while I want Education Minnesota involved here on the advisory committee, I would also like to see some student representation, because I think if they're the ones we're serving, and they have very strong opinions at this age, and we ought to be listening to them somewhat.
Thank you, Dr. Welcome, and Representative Mariani. You know, in my first clause, I was really thinking more in terms of should we return to K-8, or should we have a different construction for those middle years? There's so much emphasis in communities today on that small school, and so in the reading that I started to do some time ago, I was talking about K-2, 3-8, 3-5, 5-8, 6-8, and so that's what I was intending there. And I think your suggestion is well taken, because you're looking at flexibility also, but maybe not in the same way that I was when I, you know, wrote this bill.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Slocum,
in answering that, actually there are kids that go that would go to a K-8 program and benefit greatly. It'd be terrific for them. There are kids that probably never be with elementary age students in middle school, and they're going to get through middle school on their own too, and so maybe a 7-8-9 configuration. I guess what I'm saying is that I would hope that this task force would go for a spectrum of options so that the student doesn't have to fit the program. The programs are there to fit the student's needs.
Thank you for that suggestion, and I think that would certainly, thank you, Mr. Chair, be considered by this advisory task force. I can't imagine that they wouldn't make that a major part of their discussion.
Our final question is from Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chairman Mariani, and to Representative Erickson, I have a line of questions, but first of all, when this task force comes back, are you expecting that the Department of Education will put together kind of a resource packet and distribute it to the middle schools and ask them to look at it? And I guess why I'm asking that, are we going to end up mandating what the middle schools are supposed to do? If we're not going to mandate what the middle schools are supposed to do, then we're going to send out a bunch of recommendations to the middle schools. And if we're going to send out a bunch of recommendations to the middle schools, then why don't we allow the principals of the middle schools around the state of Minnesota to look at what are best practices around the state or around the country and implement those in the individual school districts rather than putting together a task force to look into this issue? So I guess I'm just looking for, do we really need the task force? And I'd really like your opinion on that.
Representative Welty. You know, to be honest, I don't know how the discussions actually began on redesign of the high school. I think, for the most part, they started to come about many years ago in discussions among teachers, school administrators, and parents. And whether or not an advisory task force is the way to accomplish this possible redesign, I don't know. But I think the conversation has to start at some point, and I really would rather not mandate anything at this time. I have some money in this bill, and, you know, I realize that, you know, if this $20,000 is set aside, then it's not going to be in some other place, and so maybe, you know, that can't be done. But I think there could be a variety of ways that this could be done. And I'm open to all sorts of suggestions, and, you know, maybe this is not the way to go. Maybe these kinds of discussions need to percolate among principals, as you said. Maybe they need to lead the charge on this. Maybe they need to look at best practices and come together. Maybe this is not something for the commissioner to do. But I introduced it so I could get some discussion on it, and I thank you for your your suggestions.
Let me represent Wellesley because Chair Greiling is threatening to pull one of my grant programs out of the omnibus bill. So.
Representative Erickson, I think it's good that you brought this forward and raised the issue. Yes. And I think as we look at the graphs, I definitely think that it's an issue that needs to be looked at. I'm just wondering if the task force is the best way to go about it. And I'm just, in my mind, I think that principals around the state should really be looking at what they should do to increase the test scores, increase the academic success of the students in their district. And I don't necessarily agree that we need a task force to look into that. And then one last thing. The school that I came from didn't have a middle school. And I'm wondering how many schools around the state do not have middle schools. It with the consolidation, they ended up implementing a middle school, but we had a junior high school and a high school, and they were combined. So we had 7 through 12 in one building, K through 6 in another. So we didn't have a middle school. And there may be school districts that really don't have that middle school concept.
There are 741.
Very, very quickly.
There are 741 middle schools, but they come with different descriptors. But that's what falls under the department's middle school definition.
Okay.
But some are 712. I have them in my district. Some are 678. But they're clumped under middle school. They may be junior high. So very good comment.
And Chairman Mariani and to Representative Erickson, I guess if this bill was to go forward, hopefully there is a concept of middle school that incorporates the schools that don't necessarily have 6 through 8 in one building.
Thank you.
Members, there's going to be two motions here very quickly. I apologize, Representative Debner. We're not going to be able to get to a bill. We will hear it on Tuesday, however.
Yeah.
Members, Representative Erickson renews her motion that House File 2023 be recommended to pass and refer to Finance Committee with a re-referral to the K-12 Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Members, Representative Walton, can you move our March 15th minutes?
Mr. Chair, I move the March 15th minutes as recorded.
Representative Walton moves approval of the March 15th minutes. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. Members, this committee is adjourned until next Tuesday.